Please welcome Dennis Meisner, Head of Collections Management at the Minnesota Historical Society.
Well, the crazy thing about me introducing Mark Green is that he really does need no introduction, especially in this gathering, and certainly not from me. In fact, he really should have shown the courtesy to explain who the devil I was before I got up here to introduce him, but that's the way these things go. Mark has made a household name for himself and a well-known quantity through any number of channels. He has written widely, usually bluntly, on a jaw-dropping range of important archival topics, including things, of course, that he knows absolutely nothing about. And he'll demonstrate that again in just a few minutes. Mark has occupied numerous elected and appointed leadership positions in SAA, in the Midwest Archives Conference, in SHRAB boards, and in other associations. He has tutored, mentored, befriended, collaborated with, and argued with, mostly argued with, a big slice of the American and international archivist community. Oh, and he's sometimes really, really crabby. But Mark Green, for all his legendary crotchetiness, can also be the most gracious and generous of people, something that is well remarked by his friends. Oh, and I fact-checked that with all three of them before I got here this evening. As well as by his many collaborators over the years. Here's an illustration taken from my own notes of an actual phone conversation of just a few years ago. Me. Hey, how about Meisner Green? That has a nice ring to it. Mark, not so much. Me again. M, of course, would hit that sweet spot right in the middle of the alphabet. Mark, I don't think so. Me, I'm older than you. Technically, that makes me the senior partner. Mark, no. Me, oh, please, I'll give you $50. Mark, go away. Anyway, I've already used it that way in a bunch of footnotes, and it's going to have to stay the way it is. And me, fine. But enough of that. I was hired to introduce Mark, and that means I'm pretty much required under contract to find something good to say. So good luck to me on that one, and here's my best shot. Intellectually speaking, Mark gets around a lot. At the archival buffet table, he's a decided omnivore. We all share this to some extent. You can be an electronic records specialist, but when pressed, you can still pull off a pretty smart remark about, say, the permanence of gall-based inks or something like that. But Mark, unlike most of us, makes a really annoying habit of speaking in an erudite voice on a truly wide range of important topics. Although his heart lies in the area of archival appraisal, he has written and spoken with equal authority on such dispersed topics as privacy and confidentiality, on the administration of business records, on archival program management, on many aspects of college and university archives, and on the nature and meaning of records, service to users, and of course on processing and description. Still some years shy of geezerhood, he has already contributed a legacy of 21 published articles and book chapters to the archival literature. And even more maddening, Mark does none of this at a B level. Now, I grant you, the archival community is home to many brilliant people. You would, for instance, be hard-pressed to elbow your way through a fellow's reception without spilling your drink on one or another genius. The notable thing about Mark, though, is that he's not just another smart kid in the room. He's really the utility fielder among them. His publications in several of these areas have received awards, have been reprinted in anthologies, or have received other critical distinctions. And Mark is a great collaborator. The large number of us who have worked with Mark on big projects are among the luckiest of SAA members. Mark is one of the very best of collaborators. Rather than using shared endeavors as a way to shirk work or to promote himself, Mark always seems to shoulder about 60% of the effort in everything he does. He uses collaboration as a tool to leverage knowledge in addressing a problem and to thereby produce a superior result to that he might have achieved working on his own. The goal is almost always building up the profession's knowledge base, not serving his own ego. This, to my mind, is a mark of some greatness. His mentoring and his friendships within the profession have been no less notable or important. Mark has, beginning fairly early in his own career, influenced careers of a large number of younger archivists who I think found meaning and motivation in his pragmatic, frank, and pugnacious advice in so many areas of archival thought and endeavor. He has influenced people by his actions in the profession and by the passion of his writing and teaching, and not by calling attention to himself. In all of these actions, he has, in a real way, helped to shape the American archival profession. Mark's career is a retelling of the classic rags-to-riches story of the American archivist. I made that last bit up. After earning his master's degree from U.S. history from the University of Michigan, he served for 4 years as the college archivist of Carleton College. He spent the following 10 years as curator of manuscripts acquisition at the Minnesota Historical Society, from which experience he built a national reputation as a thinker in the areas of appraisal, reappraisal, and deaccessioning, and the management of business records and congressional collections. He went on to serve for 2 years as the head of research center programs at the Henry Ford Museum in Greenfield Village. In this capacity, he deepened and expanded his thinking about processing management and service to end users. Mark is now director of the American Heritage Center at the University of Wyoming, where he continues to glower and fulminate from a higher elevation. It was here, in this situation, that Mark first came up with a very quotable catchphrase, "If it ain't broke, don't process it." Or IIABDPI. Yep. That one got fixed in the first stable release. And what I've been relating here are what I might call the Mark Green core values: intelligence and a high voltage intellectual energy, original thinking, dedication to his profession and to its audiences, and a pragmatic approach to solving archival problems. In that sense, they presage his presidential address this afternoon, in which he posits a set of common values that he hopes can be agreed upon by all practicing archivists. As always, his ideas are thoughtful, assertive, and have the success and well-being of the greater archival community firmly in mind. His remarks will challenge us today, as Mark has always challenged us before. So, having just listened to myself and hardly believing my own ears, I guess we can count ourselves pretty lucky, after all, to have spent this year under the benevolent and talented fist of Mark Green. I think it's no exaggeration to say that Mark has expended heroic efforts in advancing the agenda of SAA and the American archival community during his presidential year, in the areas of archival advocacy, in political engagement, especially with regard to presidential records and the PAR initiative, and in moving forward the important points of SAA's strategic plan. Mark has kept our whole profession moving forward and has shown his dedication to the task and his talent in getting many jobs important to all of us done during his presidential year, despite so many other things that he's involved with. And since I still own the microphone, I want to add something on a purely personal level. If you know Mark, as many of you do, only by his brilliant writings and presentations, then you don't know the half of him. Mark is the best of friends and colleagues, the most generous, thoughtful, helpful, and unselfish. And with that, enough from me. Ladies and gentlemen, Let me introduce to you, in this corner, wearing white trunks, with a lifetime footnote count of 5,107, the Earl of End Users, the Marquess of Manuscripts, the Duke of Donor Relations, the Prince of Processing, the undefeated Supreme Sultan of SAA, Mark Green.
Time has pretty much come just to have the introductions and skip the presentations. I want to express my deep thanks to Dennis for his willingness to introduce me, and my even deeper thanks that he did not feel the need to read my resume on YouTube. Family, friends, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, I'm proud but even more humbled to have been elected to serve you as president this past year. SAA has given me more than I can repay, but I hope my service has given something meaningful in return. It's been a year in which I collaborated and learned much more than I led, and a year I will never forget. I thank you for giving me this honor and opportunity. I'm proud but even more humbled to be here this afternoon, asked to give an address worthy of the time and attention of a thousand or so of my colleagues. Even more than proud and humbled, however, I am nervous beyond words and ask you to kindly overlook my dry mouth and trembling hands. In 1985, my first year in my first permanent archives position, I attended my grandfather's 85th birthday. In attendance were many relatives, of course, and one distant cousin, an elderly deaf gentleman who was an expert at reading lips, asked me what I did for a living. I faced him so that he could see my lips, and I said, "I am an archivist." He blinked and looked back at me. "A what?" he asked. "I am an archivist," I repeated, "an archivist." He looked blankly and said he had no idea what I was saying. It was a word he had never encountered before, and he could not read it on my lips. This was not an auspicious start to my encounters with relatives that occasion, none of whom, it turned out, had ever heard of an archivist. I immediately fell back on this simple but grossly misleading explanation. I'm a cross between a librarian and a historian. This seemed to pacify my cousins, uncles, aunts, and grandfather. But of course, it was not particularly satisfying for me. I soon changed the short explanation of archivist to someone who, quote, "identified, appraised, preserved, arranged, described, and provided access to historical material," close quote. But over the years, I've become more and more dissatisfied with this litany of our tasks. As I've suggested on past occasions, one of our profession's weaknesses is that we tend to focus too much on our processes and not enough on our purpose. How many of us, when asked what an archivist is, retreat to reciting our core functions? This list is apt to reinforce a public perception that archivists are functionaries, concerned with doing things rather than with why they're done. As John Fleckner has recently admonished, quote, "Our attention must go beyond how we do archives work to why we are doing it," close quote. In my early years as a professional, I was consumed with those daily tasks, too consumed with them to give much thought to why I was doing them. It turns out I was not alone. A 1984 report to SAA by a professor of marketing, looking at resource allocators' perceptions of archivists, found that few saw archivists as important enough to fight budget battles for and this, the report concluded, was largely due to archivists' inability or unwillingness to define and promote themselves. Archivists, the report noted, were perceived to have some worth but no power. Higher-level administrators saw archivists as having, quote, the impotence of virtue, which is expected to be its own reward, close quote. In summarizing the report, SAA's Task Force on Archives and Society noted, quote, archivists are viewed as quiet professionals carrying out an admired but practically frivolous activity. Unfortunately, archivists have not disabused them of their misconceptions, close quote. In a related article, then-President David Gracie concluded, quote, is there any doubt that the most basic, if not the first, step we must take in changing the public's image of us is changing our own impression of ourselves, and thus the image we project, close quote. Defining ourselves in terms other than what we do each morning speaks to our ultimate ability to communicate our value to resource allocators, to find a suitable and sustainable place for ourselves in this information age, and to define and assert our power as a profession. Yes, power. Not a word we frequently associate with our profession, particularly outside government archives, and even rarely then. But, quote, the distinctive roles and specialized skills of professionals confer considerable power, close quote, according to one sociologist of occupations. And in a presentation to an institute of senior academic librarians, Harvard librarian Robert Darnton recounted an anecdote of one of his associate librarians who, upon being asked, what's it like to be a librarian, had taken to answering, it's all about money and power. And so it is with us, though one might hardly know it by eavesdropping on our conversations or reading our articles. How do we claim and exercise power? When we seek resources, we cannot continue to behave as if we deserve resources and recognition because we are meritorious, that is, because we do good work. Of course, we must do good work, but we have to actively seek resources and recognition, and that is done by exercising the tools of professional power at whatever hierarchical level one happens to reside. All of us should demand, cajole, bargain, finagle, collect points, win friends, influence people, and in general, do whatever it takes to build and exercise power for our programs. This is, of course, part of an overall goal of replacing the image of the lab-coated, dust-coated, withdrawn and quiet archivist preciousizing over old stuff and dead storage with an image and self-image of a confident, articulate, savvy professional. Quote, archivists need to translate their importance into more power, close quote, said the 1984 report. How do we do that? The answer is twofold. First, archivists must recognize that power is grounded in our values. Values are the embodiment of what an organization stands for and should be the basis for the behavior of its members. The problem with this argument is, of course, that before it can be put into play, archivists must define our values. Second, archivists must recognize and exercise our power. In considering this matter, I've concluded that although power flows from values, it is sometimes most useful and least complicated to discuss values and power together because they are often intertwined. Ultimately, then, I see the answer, or at least an answer, to the questions, who are we, why are we here, and how can we do what we need to do, in a definition of our core values. And what are our common set of values? We've had many attempts to identify some values or other, but so far as I know, there's been no attempt to do what the ALA has done and formally define core values of the profession. So let me start the conversation by laying out what I think they are, or ought to be, not in any formal order. One, professionalism. Two, collectivity. Three, activism. Four, selection. Five, preservation. 6, democracy. 7, service. 8, diversity. 9, use and access. And 10, history. I'd like to take some time with each of them, apologizing in advance for the cursory nature of my analysis because of the amount of time I have here. Professionalism. Perhaps it should go without saying that archivists should have the characteristics of professionals, though there has been much discussion about whether we meet the qualifications of a profession. I strongly believe we do, but that we do not always act as if we believe ourselves to be professionals. One of the most salient features of a profession, according to one author, is that its practice, quote, is based on specialized knowledge, not knowledge that is intuitive, informal, and cookbooky. A professional's knowledge is deeper and more sophisticated than that of an ordinary worker, and it is supposed to be grounded in well-established theories and conceptual schemes that give intellectual coherence to specific facts and procedures, close quote. Sadly, not all archivists take this professional need seriously. We see an awful lot of intuitive, informal, and cookbooky knowledge being exchanged on our listserv and presented in our sessions, the ubiquitous, that's how we done it good papers. What I want to focus on are the professional characteristics of internalizing a common set of values, defining our importance, and claiming our power. All three identified as crucial by sociologists of work. To a certain extent, our importance lies with our set of values, but of course, these values must be communicated, always reached for, and when necessary, explained. Beyond that, however, our importance lies in much broader, deeper assertions of relevance to society. These will never be such that they vault us to importance equal to doctors and lawyers, or even the engineers who design the dwellings we live and work in. But we have to begin to rally around definitions of why we are here that mean something to non-professionals. As Rand Jemison has stated, quote, we can overcome the public's lack of knowledge and understanding about archives. We can explain why archives are essential in modern society, close quote. Examples can be esoteric, such as, quote, our work is a reaffirmation of the value of human life and a celebration of the human spirit, close quote, which is a phrase turned by Maygene Daniels. Or they could be more prosaic, such as explaining the concrete uses to which archives of all kinds can and have been put. We should have a broad range of examples in our arsenal, both for archives in general and for our particular institutions. Value number two, collectivity. I use this term to signify the importance both of context and of aggregation in how we view the world. Archivists value aggregations of material, record groups, collections, series, phones. We have developed descriptive tools designed to work with aggregates. We believe that aggregation is both an essential reflection of the organic nature of record keeping and a recognition that context matters in fully understanding individual items. This should perhaps go without saying, except that our digitization mania has reinforced a long-standing contradictory fascination with individual items. There's no reason for this to be so. Repositories as diverse as the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh and the Smithsonian's Archives of American Art have amply demonstrated the utility and efficiency of mass digitization and aggregate metadata in digitization programs, and while at NHPRC, Max Evans called for the very same orientation. With Dennis Meisner, I've beaten half to death the horse of shunning focus on individual items in paper form. And in an upcoming article, I will argue the same for electronic records. A relentless focus on the aggregate is part of what sets us apart from librarians and museum curators in the cultural heritage business. Collectivity goes beyond the material within a collection and should encompass, for example, the way we approach collecting or acquiring as a whole. We should be making acquisition decisions based not on one-off, this looks interesting decisions, but on well-planned policies that approach the documentation universe broadly. We should be seeking documentation that builds upon itself, collections and record groups that interrelate, and description approaches that help to make those interrelationships clearer for our users. Our ability to work in the aggregate is also an important source of our power. While other cultural professionals struggle with the mass of individual items before them and require ever-increasing budgets to undertake their missions, consider, for example, the various projects to publish the papers of the Founding Fathers, archivists offer an alternative path, a path that many resource allocators will, in some cases, see as an attractive alternative to item-level work, a path that, through our values, leads to power. Collectivity is also a key source of power when it applies to how we treat colleagues, sister institutions, and allied professions. There is strength, of course, in numbers. While there is advantage to a certain degree of diffusion, such as the sections and roundtables within SAA, which take advantage of common interest, or the regionals that take advantage of common geography, fracturing into smaller and smaller organizations based on subsets of archival functions, institutions, or formats endangers the entire archival enterprise. There is also power in strategic alliances. If we are clear enough about our own identity, we need never fear being confused with or subsumed by related professions. Value number three, activism. I see activism as having three distinct components. First, what I would call agency, our active shaping of the historical record. Second, advocacy of archival issues and values in a variety of settings, including the political arena. And third, what Howard Zinn referred to as activist archivists, or our deliberate decisions to give voice to the otherwise underdocumented individuals and communities in our midst. Our values include a recognition, acceptance, and deliberate application of our own agency in the work we do with records and users. This simply means that we are not neutral or objective protectors and transmitters of primary sources, but shapers and interpreters of the sources as well. Archivists have to understand, accept, and work within the reality that we, through our selection, through our description, and even through our marketing, do as much to create the documentation of the past as the individuals and organizations that generated the records in the first place. My second point is advocacy. We must more consistently project our strong belief in the importance of what we do and why we do it. In other words, we must steadily and staunchly advocate for ourselves and for our values. We need to do that as individuals, certainly, such as in the recurringly successful campaign to convince Congress to reinstate funding for NHPRC. But we must also each, and for each of our institutions, find other consistent grassroots methods of promoting and advancing the mission of archives or your individual archives. We need to pursue advocacy through our organizations when it counts, from testifying to Congress on the Presidential Records Act, to presenting our positions on copyright to the Library of Congress, to urging a U.S. District Court to ensure preservation of records relating to Guantanamo detainees. These are activities that can only be undertaken successfully by organizations, and usually national organizations, with the power of combined membership behind them. But advocacy like this comes at a cost, both in time and money. Advocacy must be a part of our professional priorities, and members should be willing to support this work with effort and with dues, as Frank Bowles will discuss further in his address on Saturday. It is also a most obvious exercise of power. My third point under activism is that I believe that as a profession, though not perhaps always as individual practitioners, we must embrace the importance of deliberately acting to identify, even create, acquire, preserve, and make accessible material documenting those whose voices in our institutions and in society are marginalized or overlooked. This is part of our commitment to the value of diversity, too, but it is also a commitment to the more abstract notion of trying to ensure documentation that reflects the true complexity of our target institutions or collecting areas. This value includes building connections to those underdocumented communities. We're only beginning to discuss many difficult issues in working with these communities. But articles such as Joel Worrell's Ethnicity as Provenance and documents such as Protocols for Native American Archival Material make clear our need to address seriously this concern. It is also, however, a source of power through our ability to expand what we do and how we serve our institutions. Value 4, selection. One archivist has written that, quote, the appraisal process determines the fate of our documentary heritage and thereby contains perhaps the only socially significant element of archival power, close quote. This is a function archivists perform, but it is also one of our values insofar as why we perform it. Archivists select because we affirm the necessity of such appraisal and our professional ability to do it thoughtfully and defensively, though not objectively and scientifically. Our institutions and society, we argue, are best served if presented a professional selection of primary sources rather than attempting to retain the totality of such sources. We preserve material because that material is important. Archivists are important and exercise power because archivists are the professionals best educated to make this selection. Yet we frequently undermine this source of power. It is the combined fear of making mistakes, of discarding a series that is 99% junk and discovering somehow later that it contained one fairly interesting and substantive item, and the holdover conviction that archivists are custodians rather than active agents in the process of preserving material that causes many of us to relegate selection to the slow, painstaking, item-level activity that it often becomes. When we avoid doing appraisal when it should be done at the point of acquisition and only grudgingly do it during processing, we are left with the question about appraisal Jerry Ham posed to the profession more than 30 years ago. Why must we do it so badly? When, perhaps if, we surmount our fears and our custodial heritage, the path to doing appraisal better is a relatively simple one. As with processing, we must accept that the size of modern collections is simply too great to permit the luxury of item and even often file level appraisal. We must accept that we cannot afford to be 100% certain that no document that might possibly be of value to someone is discarded. As Ham noted 15 years ago, quote, today's information-laden world has lessened the value of any single set of records. The documents may be unique, but the information is usually not, close quote. We must accept that good enough is better than one of these days. We must accept that selection is fundamental to who we are and why we are here. Archivists must finally realize that by doing appraisal badly, we do ourselves a huge disservice. We eviscerate what should be one of our principal sources of power. Number 5, preservation. I'm almost reluctant to make preservation a core value, because it has been misused so often as an obstacle to selection and even to use. As a profession, it has long been a truism that we, quote, balance, close quote, use and preservation. But I believe that that gives too much weight to our custodial instincts. Use should almost always trump preservation, particularly now that we have so many options for providing use with minimal preservation risks. In a major study of access in the 1990s, one-fifth of researchers reported being barred from using collections because of poor physical condition. What is the point of preserving collections that we will not let researchers use because we are preserving them? And it is not sufficient to insist that someday resources will become available to conserve the collections. Given the more recent report on our profession's preservation abilities, which found that only 20% of institutions have paid staff, whether full-time or part-time, dedicated to conservation or preservation responsibilities, such claims are mere bravado. We should instead consider giving heed to one of Maynard Bridgeford's seven sinful thoughts, in which he provocatively but seriously argued that archivists should accept that not all accession material is worth extraordinary conservation measures. Instead, he said, we should let them rot. What that would mean in practice is that we would allow them to be used up, if necessary, in the belief that some use is better than no use. We must more clearly define the place of preservation in our constellation of archival values. While in some respects fundamental to all we do, it is a means rather than an end. We preserve in order to use, and we preserve only that which we consciously and methodically select. We are not preservationists. We are archivists. And again, this is part of our power. We know that our institutions and society cannot and should not support with resources the simple instinct to preserve. We provide a professional assessment of what should be preserved and why. Otherwise, we wind up arguing that we need more space, more staff, to store more and more stuff that nobody actually uses. This is not a new formulation by any means. Society, Jerry Ham wrote in the 1980s, quote, must regard such broadness of spirit as profligacy, if not outright idiocy, close quote. Our hard-headed assessment of preservation as a means to a utilitarian end must be part of our image as sensible and practical administrators providing the best cultural or accountability bang for the buck. Value number six, democracy. While our librarian and records manager colleagues define their democratic value as supporting a generally informed citizenry and the right to free expression, archivists are more concerned with governmental accountability in a republic. The transparency and accountability of the government to the people is a hallmark of our democracy. In a letter to W.T. Berry in 1822, James Madison wrote that, quote, a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power knowledge gives. A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy or perhaps both, close quote. As SAA stated in a letter to congressional leaders requesting they overturn the executive order that undermined the Presidential Records Act, quote, as do all citizens, we believe, archivists have a vested interest in protecting the fundamental tenet of democracy that holds leaders accountable not solely to history in the long term, but to the electorate in the short term as well. Access to the records of office, to the people's office, is an essential part of that accountability, close quote. SAA has carried this principle further, protesting the alienation of mayors' and governors' records from municipal and state archives, respectively, expressing outrage over the failure of the executive office of the president to properly protect official emails, and in a previous administration, objecting when proposed appointees to archivists of the United States seemed to politicize that institution and undermine its ability to act as nonpartisan arbiter of selection and access to public records. Serving as a public watchdog in support of access is another fine example of how doing our jobs is interrelated to power. A watchdog, or if need be, a whistleblower, clearly is a valued asset. In this case, power comes from both being able to utter the needed warning and the public's expectation that we will play such a role. Number seven, service. There's been controversy over whether we do or should serve society or our institutions first. I posit that our first service obligation is to our institutions and their clients, that indeed we do not have a social service role so much as we have a value as a social good. To put it another way, as individual archivists, our allegiance is to our institutions. As a profession, we have committed to certain social responsibilities. All archives and archivists must be committed to institutional service. whether that service includes the public or not. We are charged with providing an effective and efficient connection to our holdings so that our users, whoever they are, can benefit from them to the fullest extent. Service is the linchpin between access and use, and as such of fundamental importance to our profession. Whether processing, appraising, or directly providing reference, all that we do must be seen in terms of service to our users. Ultimately, archives and archivists are foremost about people and not things. We serve our users first, not our collections. An article on marketing repositories observed that, quote, archives presented as a cultural and social institution can be marketed and understood by the target market community, close quote. I find the use of target market community interesting because it suggests to me that we are not best off addressing or serving society as a whole, but our institution's targeted audience. It is difficult to see success in marketing the abstract notion of archives to the even more abstract notion of society. Instead, we must market to our constituents, internal or external, narrow or broad, private or public. Rather than arguing about whether archives have a universal social mission, we should instead be focusing on fully internalizing the very commitment to a clearly defined institutional mission on the one hand, and to marketing on the other. Neither have we done well in the past. Targeting also speaks to one of the key elements of power, developing a constituency. Service results in more than goodwill. It results in good allies who can assist the archives. Number 8, diversity. ALA has adopted as one of its core values that, quote, we value our nation's diversity and strive to reflect that diversity by providing a full spectrum of resources and services to the communities we serve, close quote. Archivists must maintain this value just as strongly. We must renew and maintain our commitment to ensuring that our holdings adequately reflect the variety of ethnicities, religions, cultures, etc., that comprise our documentary universes. And conjoined with this, we must strive to break down barriers between mainstream institutions and underserved communities to help ensure that our user population is as diverse as our holdings. On the one hand, we should take some heart in knowing that our profession's current racial diversity equals that of the library profession, which has been focusing on recruitment for many years longer. On the other hand, neither profession's ranks come close to mirroring U.S. society as a whole. While SAA has a role to play in recruitment and in helping to break down barriers between those holding primary sources and those who might use them, most of this work must be done by individual repositories and individual archivists. How does one institution change the ethnic balance of the profession? Our college and university archives section recently proposed several ways in response to Elizabeth Adkins' call last year to consider diversity initiatives. We could help expose new audiences to archives by helping to introduce minority populations to the profession, by attending local career fairs and community events, by offering tours and presentations to K-12 and undergraduate groups, by acquiring and publicizing multicultural collections. The first step in increasing the roles of minority archival grad students is in making their communities aware of archives as a career and as a contribution to those very communities' identity and heritage. SAA's new minority graduate scholarship and other scholarships offered by regional associations can help this process along, and SAA will be exploring other profession-wide initiatives. But fundamentally, diversity must be a value and a goal for every professional. Use and access. Use is the end of all archival effort, Theodore Schellenberg declared, and we must give it a priority value. He went on, quote, it is the duty of an archivist to open up the research treasures that are entrusted to his care. He should not only accumulate and preserve documentary material, he should make it accessible to others, close quote. we should do everything we legally, ethically, and practically can to promote ease and sustain use by whomever our user groups happen to be. Dennis and I have argued long and hard to reform processing practices to speed and promote use. I believe we can and should alter other practices: appraisal, preservation, digitization, and electronic records administration, to the same end. If, for example, we really value use, then we may want to shift our digitization approaches from item-level, metadata-intensive, to lower resolution and metadata at the file and series level. This may serve more users better at the same or less cost than our traditional approaches. Of course, to determine the validity of such assumptions, we will need to directly engage our users and be willing to change our practices in response to their needs. Electronic records have to first be accepted as an essential part of our documentation universe, second, to be wrestled with an understanding that we can do something to make them usable without having the perfect answers to long-term preservation. Third, to be described and presented in the same aggregate units, series, files, etc., as traditional records. Here, too, our fear of making the wrong decisions has kept us from dealing with these records at all, at a cost to our users and our institutions. We value access because we hold use as our highest value. However, our access values are broader and deeper than this. For example, archivists should declare, as librarians have, that, quote, we respect intellectual property rights and advocate balance between the interests of information users and rights holders, close quote. Intellectual access to our collections is, however, being diminished continuously by the expansion of rights holder interests in law, so that at present our need is to support information users to the furthest extent possible. Access is perhaps most crucial when it applies to public records and is a core component of our value of democracy. The people have a right to access the papers of their elected and appointed leaders, except in narrow instances relating to legitimate national security concerns and clearly delineated privacy rights. Even then, archivists should, whenever the value of access bumps up against the need for privacy, err on the side of access. We must also, I believe, support access by not falling into the trap of believing that we should or must protect private and sensitive information outside of a few clear categories of materials defined by law. And even then, we should understand the law and not exceed its demands. Too many archivists believe it is their ethical duty to protect the sensibilities of donors or third parties, when instead this amounts to censorship and diminishment of access. One further note: not all use is direct. On the one hand, there is, as we all know, the sort of indirect use that occurs when an author or documentary filmmaker transmits his or her work to thousands of readers or viewers. But less obvious is what might be called symbolic use. Some people use some material simply by being proud or happy or secure that it exists. I believe that this is part of what Joel Wuerl was pointing to when he wrote about community stakeholders and the provenance of ethnicity. It is also part of what Jim O'Toole identified when discussing the symbolic importance of archives. It matters to some people that archival material exists, even if they never use it in any conventional sense. That, too, is a source of our power, even if it comes from people who have never entered an archive. And finally, the value of history. If one of our enduring values is accountability for democracy, surely another is our core relationship to history and culture. That is, history in its broadest meaning, transcending the specific discipline and encompassing understanding the past of any discipline. During the 1990s, our profession witnessed an assault on the cultural purpose of archives and their material in favor of an argument that our most important purpose was maintaining evidence of transactions for institutions. It seemed to me then and still today that this was a legalistic vision of archives that excluded the very value that our institutions and society most often identified and cherished about our profession. Of course, accountability matters, but not to the exclusion of history, any more than history can simply exclude accountability. However, for most people, the archival value they most appreciate and rely on is that of preserving history and culture. We see this in the studies that have been conducted of public perceptions of archives. We see it in the institutions that have received infusions of resources over the past two decades. We see it in the vast majority of uses to which our holdings are put, whether we are institutional archives or collecting repositories, and whether we serve internal clients or external ones. We make accessible for use the primary sources of history. And I think there is resonance in the word primary that we have yet to mine. Our collections are first, most important, chief, key, principal, major, crucial, all the synonyms for primary. They are also, though we might think it too trite to say, alive with possibilities, open to multiple interpretations and multiple uses. The same document, of course, can be used to support differing sides of an argument. The same item can be used one day to prove citizenship, another day to complete a genealogy, a third day to buttress a History Day paper, and a fourth day to illustrate a PBS special. Primary sources also provide historical accountability for government and other entities and individuals. So in a very real sense, archives are synonymous with history. The historical cultural, as distinct from the accountability purpose of archives and their primary sources, is less concrete and measurable. Such a purpose is much more ethereal, supporting the mystic chords of memory which form a basis for all individuals, institutions, and societies. Through our act of selection, our conscious choices in writing descriptions, and our role as mediators in reference, we help translate primary sources into sources of meaning for users. I have in the past referred, in fact, to the power of meaning as a source of archival strength and identity. It is indeed a critical source of our power. What I believe is most important is not necessarily the endorsement of these values presented today, but rather that we collectively consider our values, debate them seriously, and consider adopting a formal set as our library colleagues have done. Indeed, during its Monday meeting, I asked Council to create a task force to consider the utility and practicality of defining a set of values for the profession. Council agreed, and the task force will recommend to the next council if such a task should go forward, and if so, how and by whom. I'm glad I was able to launch such a discussion, even though I won't be guiding it. I know that some members of our profession believe that an attempt to define ourselves is inherently exclusionary and will drive individuals out of the field or out of SAA. In the broadest sense, definitions are exclusionary. Moreover, professions, by definition, are exclusionary. It is one of the key definitions of a profession. And it is true that I am suggesting these values define us as a profession. This certainly will exclude some non-professionals, not on the basis of what types of records they work with, what degrees they hold, the repositories they work in, not on the basis of private or public, open or closed, regional or national affiliation, function performed. These values I put forward are meant to define us as a profession, yes, but as a broad profession of curators and archivists, of those who work with government records and business records, of those with MLSs and those without. We must accept definition if we wish to be accorded the status of professionals. There is simply no escape. I'm convinced that if we are to be confident in answering such questions as who am I, why am I here, we need to wrestle with a set of values. In addition, as I indicated in my inaugural address, I believe we need to reshape our attitudes as well. We need to be consistently proud, creative, aggressive, and optimistic. We have to see ourselves and have others see us as the antithesis of the dusty, lonely, downtrodden, and optional bureaucrats we have seemed to resource allocators in the past. If one were to encapsulate this into an elevator speech, something I could have used in 1985 to explain my profession to my relatives, it might go something like this. Archivists are professionals who shoulder the power of defining and providing access to the primary sources of history, primary sources that protect rights, educate students, inform the public, and support a primal human desire to understand our past. Defining and committing to values and changing attitudes will increase and broaden our power as a profession and as professionals. We can do so without becoming too narrow or too obsessed with institutions, formats, and functions. We can become stronger, more powerful, more respected, and more visible. We can become more valuable, but only if we know our own values. Thank you.